Hi and welcome back. This is Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 40. It's a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK police force. So we've covered quite a bit so far if you've been following along, and something completely different this week, as they say. So around about this time, I'd been in the police for 11 years in this relatively small sort of home counties force in the southern part of the UK. I'd spent the last 7 years on the firearms, and we've talked extensively about the various work that I did there. And it was around about this time that I was thinking about promotion, possibility of becoming a sergeant. So in the UK, or certainly in England and Wales, it's a slightly different system in Scotland. You first have to do an exam called an Osprey exam. It's just the name of it. It does stand for something, I think. And basically that is based on, you know, various factors. There's an awful lot of swatting to be done. So it's all about, you know, UK law, as you'd expect. There's a lot of procedural stuff in there in relation to custody and bringing people into custody as prisoners. You know, that's got a lot of rules and regulations around it. There's also a lot of questions on something called PACE, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which very much governs virtually everything that happens in policing in England and Wales. Again, there's a different system in Scotland. So you take this exam and you obviously have to achieve a certain standard. Now, I'm not academic at all. You know, I do struggle with the swatting and sort of putting your nose in a book. I'm very much more about dealing with things that happen in front of me, you know. So I did struggle. And in fact, first time round when I took the Osprey exam, I failed. Frustratingly, I dipped it by, I think it was 5 points or something. So I was very, very close to passing. But I took it again the following year. You can take it a year later again. And I got a really good pass this time. There's different levels of pass. And certainly if you want to become an inspector, which is the rank above sergeant, you have to achieve a higher pass mark. And actually, I got the inspector's pass, which I was really pleased with. It didn't mean that I was going to, you know, jump ranks. I wasn't going to go from a PC to an inspector, you know, PC being police constable. But I was just pleased that I got the mark. You know, so I was looking around thinking what I was going to do. It was going to be quite difficult for me to stay on firearms and get promotion, because they generally didn't like promoting in-house. You know, they liked you to kind of move on to something different if you were getting promoted. And also, it can be very difficult to, you know, you're working with your pals one day as a PC, and then the following day, suddenly you're their sergeant now. Another sort of slang term in the police for sergeant is skipper down south. You know, if you're a sergeant, you're somebody's skipper. And if certainly in other parts of the UK and definitely Scotland, you know, they call sergeants gaffers. So you'd be a gaffer or a skipper, depending on where you worked. One of the many things I had to learn when I moved to Scotland. But so what happened was I was on intervention trainings we talked about. So this is the very Gucci stuff where you're smashing windows and stun grenades are going in. It's men in black and you're climbing up ladders and getting in through windows. All very exciting stuff. The only thing was, this was kind of the third year in a row that I'd been up to Wales, to this killing house, to this sort of pretend village, if you like, that had various sort of addresses and houses there that you could train on. Third year in a row I'd done it, and I was just starting to feel a bit kind of getting a bit bored with this, really, you know. And it sounds crazy, and if you mention this to other cops about this is what I was doing. And in fact, I did have a chat with a couple of my colleagues, you know, at the time, and said, oh, it's just starting to get a bit old, this, you know. I've been doing it for a while, and they thought I was crazy because, you know, some of them hadn't been there that long, and others just couldn't ever see themselves, you know, doing other things. And that's fine. It's very individual. The thing is, the police is such a massive, massive area. You know, there's so many different jobs to do within the police. I personally always felt it would be a shame if I didn't experience a few of them, you know, and try different things. Now, absolutely, there's people out there that just stay on response, you know, and do uniform work all the time. Now, you know, you cannot get a more varied job than that. It's literally something different every day. Again, another cliche, but to ridiculous levels, you know, within the police, you just do not know what you're going to be dealing with. And in fact, one of my very first sergeants always liked to say to me, and it became a bit of a standing joke, you know, he'd sort of shout for me down the hallway to come to his office. And I'd kind of come trogging into his office with my head, you know, held low, wondering what trouble I was in now. And he'd tell me, police work is a broad spectrum. You know, at one end you've got murders and car chases, you know, and armed response vehicles and things like that. And at the other end you've got theft of milk from Mrs. Miggins' doorstep, you know. But like, now he'd be holding a report in his hand, he'd say, "Now which one do you think I've got for you here?" And I'd call her, "Yes, Sergeant," you know, take the report off him, say, "I'll ring Mrs. Miggins in and see when she put the milk out." You know, as a young cop, it's not really what you want to be doing. But, you know, at the end of the day, somebody has to do it. That's how it is. So, yes, yeah, very varied. And you don't always get the exciting stuff. But I just, even with the exciting stuff, I just felt like it was time for a change. So certainly within the UK at this time, there was a lot of adverts going out for transferees into the Met, into the Metropolitan Police Service, which is the police force that looks after London. Massive, massive force, biggest force in the UK. And to give you an idea, I think it was smaller when I transferred into it, but now the Met has 46,000 cops. And the force I was coming from had 3,000. So that gives you some idea of the, you know, the differences and the sort of scale of it. You know, it's a huge unwieldy beast. And what happens is you put in an application form, say you want to transfer, obviously they look into your background. You then normally go up and have maybe a couple of days sort of assessment centre where they'll get you to carry out various things. There'll be a fitness test, there'll be an interview, you know, kind of why do you want to come to the Met, etc. And that's how it goes. They look at, you know, your discipline record, if you've got one at all. And this is probably a good time for me to talk about discipline, because some people out there, for sure, as I said last week when I mentioned the Met, will be, you know, sucking their teeth and booing and hissing because it doesn't have the best reputation. And unfortunately, particularly in the last probably 2 or 3 years in the UK, there's been a series of very, very high profile cases where serving police officers have done terrible, terrible things, you know, totally unforgivable things. And, you know, obviously the police then come in for an extra hard time as to, you know, what we're doing, basically, what is the police playing at, you know, and how can they employ people like this? And I haven't really got the answers, you know, unfortunately, in every role, I'm sure, whether you're a dentist or, you know, a bin man or, you know, whatever, there are definite bad pennies. But I think the problem is when a police officer, especially a serving police officer, you know, does some terrible act, you know, be it a murder, a rape or something like that, you know, cops are meant to be that cut above the rest in terms of, you know, our honesty, reliability, integrity, you know, all those things that are sort of core to policing. You know, the public expect you to be that person. So when you breach it so terribly, you know, in the scenarios we saw here, you know, and unfortunately, you know, they did come from the Met. So what tends to happen is everyone gets tarred with the same brush and gets lumped in together. So there's no kind of, well, this one cop in the Met did this. It's like the Met did that, or even on a wider scale, the police did that. You know, well, what happened in London has nothing to do with, you know, the police officer in, you know, Wales. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with the detective working in Scotland. And what you've got to remember is that, you know, there's 46,000 cops in the Met. Even if you said 1,000 of those were bent cops that were taking bribes and beating people up and turning a blind eye and, you know, dealing drugs or whatever it is, you know, terrible things, that means there's 45,000 cops that are out there trying to do the best they can, you know, in a really, really difficult area. You know, you very rarely get any sort of thanks for anything. And it always used to make me laugh, is probably the wrong word, but you know, the irony of the fact that, you know, you'd meet these people in the street, they'd tell you, "I hate the police." They'd literally spit on you, you know, if they got the opportunity. They hate everything about the police. They don't trust us. We're all bent, you know, we're all taking bribes. They'd never call us for anything, you know, and never have anything to do with us. And then a week later, you know, you turn up at an address and it's this same person, and he's rung you because somebody's turned up at his door with a baseball bat, you know, or he's had a neighbour dispute, or somebody's threatened him with a knife, you know, or someone's reversed into his car. And the first thing he does is ring the police and say, "Can you help me?" Now, you know, no cop I've ever worked with turns up at that door and says, "I don't think so." You know, what you'd like to say is, "No chance. You know, you said you hate us and that you'd never trust us and that you never wanted our help. So, you know, sort it out yourself." That's what you want to say. But ultimately, you're a professional, so you do, help that person out. And that's how it goes. Police come in for a really hard time. Absolutely, some police have done terrible, terrible things, and deserve to spend the next, the rest of their life in prison, which some of them are, but just remember, 90% of the police out there are really trying their hardest to do a good job, in a very difficult, difficult world, simple as that. So anyway, that's me off my soapbox. So we move on. So I went up and did my 2 days assessment and got accepted into the Met. There's a pay rise as well, because you get a certain amount of increase in pay because you get what's called London waiting, because they recognise that it's really expensive to sort of live closer or close enough to London that you can work there. Like most capitals in the world, I'm sure, very, very expensive place to live and own property. So a lot of cops travel, into London from, the home counties or outside. And mostly they use the train, as I did. You were definitely, there were some good deals available for serving cops on the trains. Sometimes you got it at a vastly reduced amount. But the downside of that is, you could be sort of having a snooze, having just done a night shift in the capital. And if someone kicks off on that train on the way back, the conductor is coming to get you to sort that problem out. There's no kind of shirking away from it and going, no, I'm tired, I don't want to help. It's like, well, we got you on this train, cheaply. I know you're a cop, there's a problem down there, and I want you to come and sort it. So, you did have to accept that. But the increase in money just made up for the fact that, yes, it did cost me a bit more to get to work in terms of, fuel for the car or a train ticket or whatever it was. So I started off, I transferred into a South London borough, right down south, one of the bigger ones. The place has got quite a reputation again for being a fair bit of trouble there. It's definitely a bit stabby for sure, as a lot of London is, but a lot of knife crime in this particular area, and some of that comes from gangs. In fact, I'd say a lot of it comes from gangs. London has a massive, massive problem with gangs, and I don't think that's unique to London. All big cities, I think, have this problem. But it can be down to, postcodes. There's gangs that, only sort of live in certain areas, drug dealing, turf wars, all the sorts of things you do see on the telly is genuine. The one thing I would say is, and again, you sort of see it in the papers sometimes, that, this is a no-go area. This estate is a no-go area for police. Well, I worked in London for 12 years and I never, ever, found or heard of a no-go area. There's places where you knew that it could be a little bit naughty and that you would you'd be stupid to go into this particular estate without a second car with you, but that's just common sense. Now if you're working rural sort of Sleepy Hollow somewhere, then you might be single crewed by yourself and no other car within half an hour of you, but you're pretty confident you're not gonna come across a gang of 10 that want to stab you to death, and that was a possibility in London. So for sure you might go into certain areas with a second car, for example. So I walked in on the first day. Now bearing in mind, this is this does vary quite a bit, but in the force that I'd worked in the busier towns, on a team on a day shift, you might have had one sergeant and maybe 10 cops if it was a reasonably big town. That would be who was covering the town that day. Now in a lot of places it could be less than that, and in the bigger places it could be more, and that would always surprise people. If ever they were in a town that they thought was reasonably busy, they imagine that there's 30, 40 cops there and there's police cars all over the place and that there's loads of us, but actually you could very quickly find, with a lot of incidents going on, that all the police were taken up with jobs. Now, of course, what happens then when an emergency call comes in? Well, that really is for the sergeant or the control room or both to manage those resources. And you might be sending someone to a fight in the street, but now a stabbing's just come in, so that probably takes precedence. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean you get it right, because you go to the stabbing and find out that it's a false call, and actually the fight in the street or that was only a scuffle where people were just pushing each other has now turned into a stabbing, or someone's been shot. And of course, again, when it comes down to the press, or a year down the line, there'll be criticism, why didn't the police send people? Well, it's a judgment call, isn't it? You have to try and send, you know, the right people to where you think they're going to be needed, but it doesn't mean you can get it right all the time. So there's a bit of that. And to give you an idea, so I turned up on my first morning in the Met, walked in, told them who I was, and was told, yeah, your team's just about to brief down there. I think it was an early turn, so it was like a 7 in the morning start probably. And I walked down the corridor, walked into this. Yeah, sorry, in between that, what I did was I went off to Hendon, which is the police training college there for the Met, and I had a, I think it was a 2-week like transferee course where you're introduced to the, you know, the computer systems and how the Met works and how the boroughs are made up and the geography of it and various things that would be useful to know. So you weren't just completely blind, but ultimately you'd been a cop anyway and you knew the law. The laws were the same, you know, so it was really the same job but with a different uniform on, you know, and they just gave you a bit of admin on top of that. First morning, stand, turn up, get directed down the corridor, walk down the corridor and open this door to find this room with what seemed like hundreds of cops in it. And there was probably, you know, between 25 and 40 cops in this room. And I could see various sergeants and an inspector. And I was thinking, nah, this can't be my team. I've got this wrong. You know, this, I must have walked into a briefing for a, you know, drugs warrant or something big that's about to happen. So I closed the door, walked back to the guy I'd just spoken to, and I said, sorry, did you say the response team is in that room there? And he went, yeah, they're about to brief, I'll show you. So we walked down, he opened the very same door I'd just come out and went, here you go, here's your team, and that guy over there, that's your sergeant. So I was looking around thinking, what are all these cops doing? There's hundreds of cops here. It wasn't hundreds, but you know, there was an awful lot of cops in this room. So I walk over, introduce myself to the sergeant. He said, oh, no problems, yeah, pleased to meet you. Come and have a sit down, you know, we're going to brief in a minute. And he said, this is the team, you know. And I was looking around, I said, I can't believe there's this many cops on the one team. And also, he explained to me that kind of 2 miles down the road was another police station that had the same amount of cops, you know, on the shift. And then another 2 minutes down the road or 2 miles down the road was another police station that had the same, you know. And I was thinking, this is just ridiculous. Surely there cannot be enough work for all these cops, you know. There's we're just going to be sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. Well, of course, that was very, very naive of me. And again, as an example, if I walked into where I had been working on a shift and there was one sergeant, 10 cops, and you were looking at the list of calls or maybe what was outstanding that you had to pick up, you know, when you came into work, you know, there probably wouldn't have been like a blue light run. They call it different things, an immediate call, a grade one call, whatever you call it, but an urgent call. There probably wouldn't have been one outstanding, because if there was, cops would be sent to it immediately. You know, it's an emergency call for a reason. So generally, obviously, you try and get there as quick as you can. There's not an exact time on it. They did try and do that at one point, but it's just impractical. You just can't do it because, you know, stuff happens. But when I was then shown the call logs that were waiting for us when I came on this early turn, so we're not talking like a Friday night, the busiest shift there was. This was like a Tuesday morning, you know, when you think there perhaps wasn't much going on. And I looked at the computer list and I could not believe what I was looking at. There was something like 25 blue light runs, emergency calls that were sitting there waiting to be dealt with. There was, you know, another 50 sort of grade two or a slight step down, you know, calls that also needed to be, you know, gone to. So suddenly the fact that there was 30 or 40 cops sat in this room didn't see very, very many. So the sergeant gave his briefing, you know, told us what was going on, told us what we could expect of the day, anything we needed to know what had happened overnight and things like that. And then he started assigning people to the different roles, you know, that we were going to do that day. So he was like, right, you two, this is your call sign, you're going to deal with that, and I want you to take this call, it's a blue light run, it's outstanding, you go now. So they're straight out the door to that, and he goes around the room and starts dishing out these jobs, right, you two go to that, you two go to this. So lots and lots of cops immediately. We've probably gone to about half or maybe three quarters of the cops sat in that room, so maybe 20, 25 cops have now disappeared and are off on their way to these, you know, numerous blue light calls that are outstanding. And then of the sort of 10 or 15 of us that were left, he started dishing out other jobs. So straight away, there was what we call, again, different things in different places, but hospital guards, hospital watches, people that have basically been arrested that are, you know, in hospital being treated, you can't just leave them there and say, oh, were you promised to come down the police station when you get released? And of course, they're like rolling their eyes. Yeah, oh, yes, officer, I'll come straight down, you know. So when people are arrested and in custody and they go to hospital, you have to sit with them. Now, obviously, that happens a lot. So, for example, they dished out and said, right, I've got, you know, 5 or 6 hospital watches. And generally, those sort of things will need a pair of officers. So straight away, that's another, you know, 10 cops that have gone. And there's now only 5 cops left sat in the room, and I'm one of them. And then we had a big custody where I was. So there was a lot of cells with people, you know, that had been arrested that were sitting in the cells. And of those cells, you have quite a few that were either constant watches or again, called different things, constant watches, something like that. So basically, this is a person who's in custody that perhaps when you get the initial questions, when you go into custody about, you know, what's your state of mind? You know, do you want to hurt yourself? How are you feeling? Do you have medical conditions? You know, do you take medication and so on? This is probably somebody who's got a history perhaps of mental health or suicidal thoughts, or depending on the scenario, if it's, I don't know, somebody who runs a driving business and they've been arrested for drink drive. So chances are, you know, they're going to lose their license, which means they might lose their business, which means their marriage might, you know, collapse. That person has literally got the weight of the world on their shoulders. So that is someone who's definitely going to be sat in that cell thinking, you know, their world is collapsing around their ears, and it possibly is. So that might be the person you go, I'm not happy with that. I'm going to put a constant watch, in which case either they're watched permanently on the cameras with a cop literally sitting there watching them sort of 24 hours, or the cell door is open and a cop is sat in the doorway with a chair there, making sure that person doesn't harm themselves. So a constant watch. And so of the 5 of us that were left, there was 4 constant watches. So 4 of those cops were sent off. So within about, you know, 5 minutes of this briefing starting and 40 cops having sat in this room, there was me left, you know. And the sergeant said, ah, right, it's just you left. I'll tell you what, you jump in with me and we'll go out and I'll give you a tour, you know, and I'll show you the various areas and the trouble spots and what have you. So it was immediately a very, very different beast, you know. And some people, again, might be thinking, oh, hang on a sec, you've come from all this great, you know, firearms background and you'd worked your way up and now here you are back at the bottom of the pile. Well, I didn't see it like that, and it really isn't the bottom of the pile. Like I said, the uniform response work is for sure, you know, the busiest place, and the place where you probably need to be the most switched on that there is in the police. But even within the police, you know, that role, the response role, is perhaps looked down on a bit, and it's not fair, you know, because it's a difficult task, and as I say, it's a very busy task, you know, and lots going on. So I spent the next, you know, week or so getting used to the area and my new colleagues and figuring out just, you know, how it all works. So I had a rough idea, but obviously it was a different place geographically and also different habits to get into, different call signs, you know, the way it worked. There was effectively what was called a CAD room, which I think it stood for computer aided dispatch. So you had a control room that was local to you that sat in your area. And when the calls came in, when somebody phoned and was in trouble and needed the police, they were the ones that were on the radio and then sending you out to those jobs. And because they were based with us in our police station, we got to know them quite well, you know, and they would know you as well. And they would also know who were the hard workers, who could they trust to do an important job, who were the lazy cops that were trying to hide, you know, and not do a lot. So it worked quite well. Personally, I thought it was a good system, you know, and it worked okay. But so we came to my first, I think it was a night shift, or it might have been like a late shift. I either finished at sort of 3 in the morning, or maybe it was a night and I was working right through. And I got crewed up with this young guy who I think at the time had maybe 3 or 4 years in the police. And I say I had 11 at this point, and was seen as, you know, sort of reasonably experienced. So we got crewed up together and we've gone out on patrol, and we knew that there was quite often you'd be assigned to an area. So we've had a lot of burglaries, a lot of house break-ins in this particular area. I want, you know, you that car and that car, I want you 2 cars to be driving around this area and sticking with this area. And we need, you know, stop searches done. You know, we might have had some suspects where we think it's this team of burglars, and we know that, you know, we have a description of them, maybe some cars they were using, things like that. So you go to a certain area and be driving around looking out for, you know, those things, particularly in those people. So we're in this area, we're driving, it's obviously dark, it's like 2 or 3 in the morning, and we can see a guy walking down the street. Now, from behind, he looks sort of adult size. He was quite big. He was maybe 6 foot tall. He was, you know, sort of 14, 15 stone, quite a big build. I mean, he was an adult size, and for all intents purposes, you know, you never would have thought he was a child. Well, we stopped him because the guy I was with said, this guy, you know, does fit the description for a couple of the burglars. And obviously, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So you are very liable to be spoken to by the police, you know, just to see kind of what you're up to or where you're going to. And not in a bad way, you know. And some people immediately, you know, got very aerated that you'd dared to stop and speak to them. But it was never, you know, it wasn't unfriendly. It was just literally, oh, hi, how's it going? You all right? You know, where are you off to? And that was how I approached it, just kept it friendly. But this particular guy, when we started speaking to him, he was okay, but he was very young. You could see when he turned round facially, you know, it turns out he was 14, so he was only a young lad. Now, from the second we stopped him, the guy I was working with was absolutely intent on getting the guy to keep his hands out of his pockets and keep his hands where we could see him. And it was getting ridiculous, you know, like every, because this kid's natural response was to every time he could was to stick his hands in his pockets and put his hood up, you know. And part of that is, you know, because you know, he's embarrassed or he feels awkward or whatever, and that's his little defense mechanism. You know, I'm sticking my hands in my pockets, I'm sticking my hood up, you know, and I'm not looking people in the eye and what have you. But we were just chatting to him, asking where he come from and stuff. But yeah, he kept trying to put his hands in his pockets. My colleague was constantly, get your hands out your pockets, let me see your hands. And even I was thinking, this is ridiculous. Now, why is this cop so obsessed with it? And I was wondering, you know, is it a Met thing? You know, is it a London thing? I don't know. I've never really come across this before, because certainly where I'd been working, it was very much more relaxed. And I must admit, in my mind, I was thinking, this is a 14-year-old lad. You know, I mean, I don't think he's going to cost us, you know, cause us too many problems. Anyway, so this carried on. Ultimately, the guy, you know, wasn't answering the questions brilliantly. He kind of wasn't sure where he'd come from. He wasn't sure where he was going. You know, he didn't want to give us his name or where he lived or anything, which he technically didn't have to. But, you know, we weren't very happy with him, particularly in the area. As I say, there've been a lot of burglaries here. So we told him that we were going to search him. And we were going to search him for stolen items. So you have to, you know, give your name, and you have to say what police station you're attached to, and you tell them that there's going to be a form filled out, and there's various sort of, you know, procedure bits you go through. At which point, both me and my colleague took hold of an arm each, a wrist each of this guy, because when you're in close to someone searching them, you don't want to give them the option of potentially, you know, grabbing something, you know, fighting with you know, punching you, or maybe trying to, you know, sort of grab your baton or handcuffs or something and use them on you. So we took all of his wrists, and the standard question that a cop asks at this point is, look, have you got anything on you that you shouldn't have? You got anything sharp on you? You know, and quite often there's a bit of kidding on with them just to, you know, break the ice a bit. Say, look, have you got any, you know, rocket launchers on you, any machine guns tucked away or anything like that? Of course, he was a bit lost on him. He was young, you know, so he just kind of rolled his eyes. But he was like, no, nothing at all, you know. And I didn't expect to find anything on him. So we started the search. And invariably, one cop should do the searching, because if you sort of take a side each, it's very easy to miss things, because, you know, you do his lower back twice, but no one does the front of his waistband or whatever, you know. So generally, the feeling is that if you've both got hold of him, just one will do the searching, or one does the searching and the sort of the holding on, but maybe from behind, so you're not so vulnerable to attack, while your colleague stands in front of him and watches everything. Because the other favourite trick, of course, is to, while you're searching, you're round the back and, you know, putting your hand down the back of his waistband of his jeans, he's managed to lower his hand, pull out the little bag of cocaine from his front pocket and drop it on the floor without you seeing. So, you know, there's various ways of doing it, but that's generally what the thinking is. So I got to his waistband, round the back of his jeans. I was doing the searching. I was standing behind him, although we had an arm each. And he said, no, nothing on me at all. You know, you won't find anything. You're wasting your time, etc. You know, you're like, okay, we're going to search anyway. And I was just patting down his back with my hand, and I could feel a big lump in there. And I was like, what is this? It feels quite hard, metallic. So I put my hand in the back of his jeans and pulled out what turned out to be a loaded handgun, which I couldn't believe. You know, I'd, up until that point, I'd never ever done a sort of basic stop search on someone. I'd found, you know, weapons and drugs and things like that, but never a loaded gun. And this was a 14-year-old lad. And I tell you this story because, firstly, it was a real wake-up call for me, which was, to be honest with you, very good at that early stage in London, in that I had to change my mindset a bit. And perhaps it helps you understand. And again, the police always come in for a hard time that, you know, they pointed a taser at my boy and he's only 15, you know. Well, you know, I'm here to tell you that unfortunately 14 and 15 year olds in big cities are carrying bad things. You know, quite often these sort of older, you know, more seasoned criminals aren't carrying this stuff themselves. They get the youngsters to carry it. And the youngsters, the young team, want to carry these things because they feel like big men, that they're, you know, they're carrying the guns. But it was a real wake up call for me. And certainly when I spoke to my colleague later, I said to him, I thought you were getting obsessed with, you know, keep your hands out your pockets and all the rest of it. And he said, well, this is what we find all the time. So he said, once you've worked up here a bit, you know, you'll be doing the same because you're protecting yourself. The fact that he's 14, the fact that he's telling you, obviously, there's nothing on him, doesn't mean he can't have, you know, a loaded handgun on him. And that's exactly what happened. So, yeah, it was a real shock to me, to be honest with you. And he got processed and ultimately ended up getting a prison sentence, although not as much as you'd expect, but he did get one, certainly. But again, he was, you know, probably a victim because he ultimately was being made to carry this for somebody else, for sure. But, you know, how much would it have taken if he'd have been of a mindset just to pull that out and shoot one of us? You know, it could have been as easy as that. And unfortunately, you know, Met cops, well, all cops, you know, are, you know, occasionally that stuff happens. Thankfully, not very often, but it does happen, even in this country, in the UK, and again in America and stuff. I realise it's a lot more common, but certainly here, you know, that's very rare, thankfully. So that's just a little insight then into my transferring forces, and now I'm into the Met. And next week we'll carry on, and I'll tell you some of the incidents that we dealt with there. Some of them are really, really nasty. And there's some really upsetting incidents that will live with me forever, for sure. And actually will be quite tough to talk about. But we'll start that process off next week. So hope it was interesting, and please keep coming back. Thanks very much for the download. Appreciate it. A few more hits on YouTube this week as well, which was interesting. So keep them coming. Don't forget, on YouTube, you can, you know, pass a comment or ask a question or something. I should be able to see that. But that's it for this week. So speak again soon. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.